I wouldn't say we fell in love right away. I think we were, as they call it in the biz, trauma bonding.
And then after 8 years of being insufferably sober, I started drinking again.
Addicts tend to be rather sensitive people.
Aren't you Marc Maron? I'm like, yeah. And she goes, what happened to you?
Hi, you're listening to Recover Girl. It's a podcast all about addiction and recovery. If you want to know more about Recover Girl, you can go to recovergirlpodcast.com. You can find out more about me and what the work I do in addiction, recovergirl.biz. I have 1,600 websites.
You're focusing really hard.
I know. I'm focusing. Hold on, because I can't remember 1,600 things if I'm not focusing. And I have a writing coaching program where I help a lot of people who are in recovery, interestingly, put together their book proposals. And it's starting again in October. And I'll just briefly say that it is a program where I take 10 students at a time and walk them through doing a book proposal. It's a 6-month program. And at the end, one of those people, if not more, gets a meeting with my agent in New York and a publisher that I know. So it's a very, very cool program. Stay tuned for more information. If you want to know now about it, even though it's still a ways away, go to alltherightmoves.com. It's right, you know, you guys, it's writer. ALLTHEWRITEMOVES.com. And with that, I'm going to introduce my guest. Say hi, Paul.
Hi, how's everybody doing? How are you doing specifically?
I'm doing well. I'm really excited that you're sitting in my living room right now. This is
surreal.
This is like a long time coming. Let's tell them who you are.
Sure.
Paul Feuer. Is that how you pronounce
that
it?
That is how you say it. Got it in one. Yeah, we've never even spoken.
I never said your last name out loud. Well, I have. No, I haven't.
No, okay. You got it exactly right. Most people say fewer is actually right. So you got it right. So,
yeah. Okay, actually, I'm going to give you a brief introduction.
Even better.
So the way our relationship started is, I would say about 2 years ago.
It was two, yeah.
2 years ago, I got the nicest, most articulate email I have ever gotten about this podcast. I've gotten emails from a lot of you, and they're wonderful, and they're often articulate, but this just blew me away, and it was the kindest email ever. And I was like, oh, what a nice guy, and I wrote back, and I was like, this was incredible.
Right.
Then, maybe 2 or 3 months later.
It was about 3 months.
Yeah. I am going to let you talk at a certain point, I promise you. I get...
Doing much better than me.
An article from you, and you go, hey, look, I just wrote this thing, how I got sober, if you want to use it, great, if you don't, great. And it was... brilliant.
Oh.
Which shouldn't have surprised me because of the email. And then suddenly you became our most prolific writer. And I think for a year and a half.
Yeah. And there was no expectation. I mean, I wasn't like writing you to like say, here's, you know, I'm auditioning for you or something. I legitimately never written a fan letter in my life to anybody, but I wrote one to you because, you know, you lived in my head for the longest time, you know, because I was listening to all of your podcasts and your shows and, you know, and I don't even know how I found your podcast, you know, when I first got sober.
You don't?
I don't remember. I looked for like sober, anything. I was sopping up any information I could about sobriety.
Yeah.
And I think you were just, you know.
Stumbled upon it.
I did.
Started listening.
I did. And while I was mowing my lawn, washing dishes, everything, that's I listened so to every sweet. Episode. I listened to the first one and worked my way back. And yeah.
And so that's it. And you know, I think you wrote about every topic under the sun. Do you know how many articles you did for After Party?
It's over 100, I think.
Oh, my God, that's so crazy.
It's over 100.
And you're just such a delight and so nice to work with.
This is way too kind.
And sent me chocolate-covered strawberries, not once, but twice. I mean, seriously.
I wasn't sure how well those things would travel. So the first
they travel.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just amazing to have you out here.
Oh,
and
so
you
much.
Have your own podcast. Tell people about that.
I do actually have two podcasts.
Massive overachiever.
I had one. I realized that I have a lot of friends that are that have much more interesting lives than me. So I have like friends that are like a NASA engineer. I have a music producer friend, some poet friends. And so that podcast is just called, I tried to come up with something. I couldn't come up with a good name, but since my last name is Fuhrer, I came up with a Furious podcast.
Love it. It's great.
I tried, you know, so it's just a, you know, one-on-one thing. And then I was listening to NPR's All Songs Considered. considered all the time. And I thought, you know, you could apply sobriety principles to this as well. You know, music that reminds you of getting sober. So I did another podcast. I have one now called Drop the Needle about recovery. And so I'm very proud of that title.
It is, but you were just a drinker.
Yeah, I was.
So the needle implies like a drug shooting situation.
It does, but I met someone in rehab named Mike, and I also know somebody who runs a music blog, and I'm always trying to pair people up. I'm always trying to, and I think you're probably the same way. Like, you should meet this person.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm guessing.
I mean, sort of. I'm a little self-obsessed, but yeah.
Well, so the three of us got together and he was a heroin addict and so that's why.
The three of you do it together or just
yes.
two?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they're available iTunes, SoundCloud, all those places.
You got it. Yep, yep.
And I should also mention that Paul has three kids and a full-time job where he manages 20 people.
That's true.
So that's a lot of productivity, and it's a testament to your sobriety.
Yeah, thanks.
I would imagine.
Yes.
So let's go briefly into your story.
Sure.
So when did you first start drinking? What happened?
Well, you know, alcoholism is kind of knots its way through my family. I mean, it's you can find it here and there. It's not with my parents, but it's you can find it hidden through my family. I don't think they acknowledge it in some ways. You
relate
know?
To that, yeah.
Yeah. So my parents not big drinkers, but everyone around them it seems to be there's somebody. But we would always have these huge, you know, these parties, Christmas time, you know, Thanksgiving, and all, and you know, drinking just seemed to elevate everybody. You know, so I'm like, I think I was like 15. And there was a Christmas party, and I decided to steal two Zimas from the fridge.
Zima.
And I knew that. But I knew even then, I didn't need just one. I needed two.
I get it.
So I brought them up to my closet in my bedroom and just sat in the dark and drank two Zimas.
How old were you?
15.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. It's not the most unique story in the world, but I'm sitting there. I just remember.
Zima is unique. Come on.
I just remember sitting in the dark, you know, feeling. And it's a very unique bottle, too, because I can still remember it.
I feel nauseous, actually, talking about it. Was it vodka and beer? I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly. It had this bright, like, citrusy taste to it.
I thought it had something to do with vodka.
It just got me, it brought
Did
me where.
Did you throw
up? I didn't, but I drank both of them very quickly. And I remember going down stairs and, you know, very surreptitiously throwing them away, the bottles. But everything made sense. You know, I could hear like the glow of the conversation downstairs. And all of a sudden I felt like I was part of that.
Right.
You know? So that's where my story starts. Yeah.
And then where did it go?
Oh my God. You know, I never really drank alcoholically at first. I just knew that I really liked how that made me feel. But I drank in college, like, you know, everyone does, I guess. And, you know, but I was always the one like, well, let's get one more shot. Let's do one more. Right. I was that guy. I was that annoying person. So.
Right. I know that person well.
So, yeah. And then it just got, you know, just got progressively worse because, you know, when I got the pressures of life, you know, I just did not want to acknowledge that I had stress in my life. I didn't want to acknowledge that all the things you just mentioned that, you know, I had, I have three kids and a job. I wasn't good at those things before.
You weren't?
No. Well, you know, if you back up that calendar, you know, go back to, you know, child number one, I was a wreck. I mean, I turned the baby monitor up really loud. So that way, you know, when passing out at night, you know, it's just, it was the perfect storm of problems. I wasn't prepared for any of it. I wasn't prepared for responsibilities at work. Wasn't prepared to be a parent.
Right. But they just happened to you, these things?
Well, yeah, my wife will disagree, but.
So you graduate from college, 4 years. Mm-hmm. You look very normal on the outside.
Sure.
You're in the Midwest.
Yeah. So I'm from Ohio, and my parents owned the company that made Crash Test Dummies. So.
Wait, what do you mean? Not the band?
Not the band.
I don't know what those were.
Well, for all the auto manufacturers across the world, the actual Crash Test Dummies.
Okay.
That they would put in cars and ram them into walls. My parents made those.
That's so bizarre.
It is bizarre. So they were really
You're the heir to Crash Test Dummies? Is that what you're trying to say?
I guess. I mean, I
don't. Do they still exist?
Well, they exist in a different.
They sold it.
They sold it after like 10 years, but they were very paying it. They paid much more attention to that than my drinking or anything else that was going on.
And you have siblings, right?
I do. I have a sister. She's 5 years younger.
Okay.
Yep.
And there you go, off into the world. And did you do something in finance or banking?
I do.
I don't know what it is.
Well, I was just telling my brother-in-law last night, I'm not even up on the banking industry myself, and I work in it.
Right.
I couldn't recite any of the regulations or anything like that, but I'm a communications manager.
I'm glad, because I wouldn't want
to
hear anything.
I remember I sent you an email once just telling you what I was doing that day. You're like, my eyes glazed over after the first sentence.
I did it on purpose. It was a very long email, to be fair.
It was awful.
So, okay. And so did you immediately go into that industry?
No, I started off, I try to take every shortcut imaginable in life. So I was like, when I was in undergrad, for 4 years, I was a good writer. So I just went into English and I was like, yeah. So there's no tests.
No.
You know, I artfully even dodged taking any sciences. I cobbled together like a minor that was, I'm not even joking, sociological astronomy. I'm not even joking.
You know what? I thought astronomy was going to be a total gut class in college, and it was the hardest thing, and I dropped it.
Oh, my God.
It was so hard.
Well, we got to like the 200 level. All of a sudden, there's math.
I couldn't do it. I went for nutrition instead.
Did you really?
That was easier. No, I majored in creative writing. Same reason. No. Same reason. I was like, no tests. Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't think I was going to do anything with it.
Right. So my parents own this company, you know, and so afterwards I had no plan.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no plan in life.
I think is common among alcoholics.
Well, that makes me feel a little better.
Right. I didn't like, you know, when people are like, when I grew up, I wanted to be, and I was like, I wanted to be glamorous. That's all.
Well,
that's
more aspiration than I had. Well, I just graduated, and I kid you not, Anna. It was maybe a couple weeks before graduation. It sort of dawned on me that I needed a career, like a job.
I was this exact same.
Were you really?
And I'm looking around. I'm going, wait, you're going into the Morgan Stanley trainee program. You're going to acting school. How did you do this?
Well, there were people all the time that I just thought they were doing the same thing I was. I was just ripping it up every night, going to party. But I thought that's what they were doing. I thought
me
that was career.
Me too. It was shocking.
Yeah, they're all doing internships and things.
Totally. I did do internships, but because we were required to. They didn't help me figure out my future.
I went to a school in the Midwest that's, you know, flatter than a pool table, and it's just, you know, all fields and, you know.
Right.
The school that I went to in the town that it's embedded in, Bowling Green, is home of the tractor pulling competition in the world. So
that's something.
I can't even.
So, but you stayed there.
I did. And then my parents very kindly gave me a job at their company.
Okay, that was nice.
Yeah, it was. But it was basically like, all right, our son is kind of lost. And I joined a band for no reason.
Interesting.
And yeah. I learned how to play guitar strictly. I learned like 6 chords.
So, right.
But it's that way I could go to bars and play and get free beer. So, but then I went to grad school where it really took off. The drinking really took off.
What were you studying?
Well, of course, I just went English again.
You have a graduate degree in English?
I do.
I'm terribly intimidated, but it's a master's?
Yes. I discovered midway through that I did not want to do the PhD track.
My mom did that.
Really?
I think that was a good decision.
Well, midway through, I was just like, I wasn't taking any of this seriously because I was, you know, I was doing the papers. I'll go back and read those papers now. You know, I'll stumble across them. I'm like, who wrote that?
You mean because they're terrible or good or?
No, I can't tell. They're just a different person.
I know.
You know that feeling too?
Just well, also, I have a belief that that writing can't be taught, and that a lot of what, you know, writing is writing.
Right.
You know, I majored in creative writing and all we did was workshop our stuff. Nobody sat down and said, this is how you write a sentence. And I think it's damaging the way that they teach you to do papers. And
really, yeah.
I do, because I would say the biggest problem I run across in the people that I coach is that either writer's block or they're writing too academically because they have this idea of how a writer should write.
Yeah.
And a writer should write the way they talk.
And it's all artificial and it seems very, it's all ornate, you know.
And it's not.
For no reason. It's empty.
Exactly. It doesn't really teach you anything, in my opinion, except how to sound not like yourself.
Well, it's funny you're in creative writing. It was not funny, but I avoided creative writing, not because I thought that there was no money in that, because there's no money in English either.
No.
But I didn't want to be in a workshop. I didn't want people critiquing my work. I was that thin-skinned, you know? And so now I'm like, you know, bring it on, you know, whatever. I'm more open to that. But I was so scared of that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And then look, cut to today where there's mean. I don't think you've ever gotten a mean comment on any of your stories.
Oh, no. But I mean, you really, I mean, I told you before, I mean, I have you to thank for two things. One is that you helped me get sober very early on. I mean, I owe a lot of my sobriety to you, but you also helped me find my voice as a writer. I mean,
you had it.
I didn't, you know, maybe the Wizard of Oz ending, I had it all along. I don't know, but.
Yeah, you did have it all along.
I don't know these things. This is like, you know, I'm just a guy, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that now it makes sense. I didn't know you studied English and all of that stuff. Like, you didn't just stumble across being a great writer as a banker. I know you're not a banker.
But. No, but put study in air quotes.
Because
because
you graduated.
I did, and I graduated well. I mean, I graduated, you know, because I went to Arizona State for grad school.
Interesting. Interesting.
Because I just wanted to get away from Ohio.
Yeah.
But that's where the drinking really took off. And, but yeah. that's, you know, the writing, I was, you know, I'd write these, this 20 pages of dribble and think it was amazing. You
right,
know, and
right,
give
right.
it circulated to people. And they're just like, this is, but they would very kindly tell me, you know,
yeah. Yeah,
this is pretty prose, but means nothing.
So you keep drinking, you mm-hmm. get your master's.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens to you?
It's more not what happens to me. It's what doesn't happen to me. I kept right. expecting, I just kept expecting all these wonderful things to happen to me.
Yeah.
I felt like I was entitled to so many things. Like, where's my successful life?
Yeah.
You know, where's my book deal? You know, right. where's my, but I wasn't writing anything.
Right.
So, I mean, I wasn't writing anything, you know, of substance, but so I freaked out. Like maybe a week after I graduated Arizona State. And I mean, it was not a healthy environment for me. And I moved back home in with my parents.
Okay.
Yeah. It might be the natural progression of where you go as an, you know, with a master's in English. I don't know.
Yeah. I told you my mom got a master's and then a PhD.
Yeah.
It's a brutal path.
I'm impressed. I'm impressed by anybody that can hold that path and do it well.
Yeah. Yeah. Just not a lot of job possibilities at the end.
My sponsor is a PhD, and he has a really niche field, but I mean, it's amazing. I just have so much, I'm so impressed by people that go that far and really commit to it because I wasn't committed to anything.
And so your drinking, was it daily at this point?
Yeah, at this point. Yeah. And I remember somebody kind of sort of implied that I was an alcoholic like in grad school, and that offended me yeah. so bad. I'm like, I am not like that.
Yeah,
I am not that person.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was drinking every day. I was drinking beer for sure. That was just the background at a certain point, like the wallpaper of my life.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then, you never did drugs?
No, not really. So here and there, but nothing like consistent. So.
And what were the consequences aside from the fact that you had moved back home with your family?
Okay. So I moved back home and the consequences started building up. And I really think, and I tell people this a lot, is I feel like drinking or any addiction has like three phases. Like, you know, it's fun.
You didn't make this up. Fun with problems, fun, then problems.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a...
Is that a thing? You know where I got
it
from?
You thought you made that up?
No, I didn't. I was going to quote that. You know who didn't tell me this, but I read it in an article with Dennis Quaid. So.
Oh, interesting.
So I cribbed it from him. So,
yeah, thanks, Quaid.
Yeah. So who I saw, by the way, in Scottsdale once. So.
You did? Yes, I've never seen him in the flesh. God, I had a thing for him when I, you know. He's a handsome man. I haven't seen him in something for a while.
Yeah.
This is what's known as a diversion.
Sorry, I'll get back on track.
So
I just really want to come here and talk about Dennis Quaid.
Who doesn't? So fun, you and Dennis had fun, then fun with problems, then just
yeah,
problems.
So the fun with problems was basically you know, I'm a garden variety alcoholic, but I had immediately when I moved back to Ohio, they threw me a, you know, welcome home party, and I got a DUI like 2 weeks later. So mm-hmm. it's like, and then I had a broken engagement. I broke off my engagement with my, you know, wife now, but we went through a really
interesting.
Yeah. Well, she won't call it interesting, but it is. There's a whole story there. That would be a second diversion. That would be another hour long.
And so what, but you were still functioning?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I was teaching random classes at community colleges at that point, cobbling together the best existence I could. You know, I'm sleeping very little. And then it would, you know, I'd be, you know, just out of my head most of the time. I'd show up to class like either hungover or drunk. I remember very
drinking during the day.
Yeah. And I very distinctly remember one time I went to class to teach. I was, you know, went to school. And I was like 2 hours early. And I thought, I'm just going to take a nap in my car. And I woke up 3.5 hours later and two of my students are like staring at me outside my car window. And right. it was just brutal. You know, and so it was just a night. It just snowballed. But there's so many little things that I never saw that they were problems. Like, I just figured that everybody around me had DUI. So why wasn't a problem for me? You know,
right. Did you have more than one?
No, just one.
Right.
But everybody I knew around me had a DUI. It was like a right. badge of honor. You know?
Right. So, it was just like a normal thing.
Right.
And so then what happened?
So things just got progressively worse. So I lost my job as a teacher, and then I pretty much confessed to, you know, my then girlfriend, now wife, that, you know, this is what's going on. And she's a nurse, so she's very wired to want to help, mm-hmm. and she's very compassionate, very wanting to, you know, try to solve a situation. So, you know, so we got close, you know. we got engaged again, and I moved just a couple hours south. So I moved out of my parents' place, mm-hmm. and I got a job as an editor at a publishing company. It's an educational publishing company everybody knows. Just is McGraw-Hill.
I cannot believe I didn't know any of this. Okay.
Well, I saved it all for this show.
I mean, exclusives, at least to me.
So I got an editor. Yeah, so I was editing textbooks. Uh-huh. But it was just, the alcoholism was, I was constantly every night going to a happy hour, coming up with an excuse. And there's, you know, dozens of people my age in my, you know, mid-20s, you know, I'm like, let's go out tonight. And I would go out every night with somebody different.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't coming home very often. But then next thing I know, we're having a baby.
Right.
And I just couldn't handle it. I just wasn't equipped for any of this.
Right.
But, that's not a cop-out. That's just me being me. So
right.
It was awful.
And how long are you sober now?
Almost, it's 3.5 years. I'll be 4 in January.
And what happened that got you sober?
A number of things. The worst situation for me, I mean, I can't really pinpoint it on a specific bottom, but a bad one would be forgetting to pick my son up from kindergarten one day, and they called me, and that was pretty bad.
Where were you?
In my couch, passed out, or on my couch, passed out. I could have been in it too.
I know. I was like, that's impressive. So,
I had my neighbor knocking on the door. My wife was freaking out. But I mean, even that didn't shock me out of.
Right.
But I eventually, it was a number of those sorts of things. You know, I'd wake up peeing in a sock drawer or something. Right. Those are just like everyday things for me, it was just unbelievable. But I look back, I'm even telling you now, it feels surreal. You know?
Yeah, I know the feeling. Like you feel like you're describing somebody else.
Yeah, I'm sitting here just having a kind of an out of body experience. I'm like, that was really me. I figured I was an alcoholic. I knew I was, but I probably should start admitting to it. Mm-hmm. So I tried starting to get sober myself, mm-hmm. and that was a bad idea, mm-hmm. because then I don't do well with pain. I don't do well with uncomfortability. I don't do well with anything. And it probably on a scale of 1 to 10 was like a 2, mm-hmm. for most people. But for me, it felt like a 9. Mm-hmm. My brain was, constantly worrying at night. I couldn't sleep. I was hearing... I would hear like auditory hallucination, people telling me.
From the detox, you mean?
Yeah. It was only like a day or two.
How much were you drinking when you did that?
At that point, as you well know, as Dennis Quaid would tell us,
yes.
So
problems.
You're right. I was in the problems phase. I was drinking a pint of vodka, probably more than that, and then a ton of beer.
Right.
So I honestly couldn't tell you at that point. And I remember calling. So we were looking at some rehabs and some clinics and things around us. And what would, it's the saddest conversation too. Like what is our insurance going to take, and all this stuff. And at this point I had quit my job just for no reason, mm-hmm. because I didn't like the people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I went there and that was not a healthy experience. And then,
went to treatment, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that you had a bad treatment experience.
Yeah. I just wasn't built for that world. No, I don't think anybody is, but yeah.
I was. I'm serious.
Really?
Built for treatment?
Yeah, I'm saying like the treatment center.
Well, I did outpatient, so I can say that. But like, I loved it.
Yeah, not me.
Really?
Yeah. So I go there, and I was just prove it to me. Like I don't belong here. I'm not like you people.
You would say that out loud. I can't.
Oh, of course.
It.
I can't.
Oh, yeah.
No. It was all internal. So I'm not that. Not that awful of a person. But I'm sitting there thinking it for sure. And it wasn't, see people, these 1,000-yard stares and just walking around in their, pajamas, and I'm not realizing that I'm one of them.
Yeah.
So, but I was inpatient for about 5 or 6 days just for the detox. And then I said, I have to get out of here. So I left, and promptly 2 weeks later, I relapsed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
And then what happened?
Then I didn't want to admit that I had relapsed, because I'm really bad about telling everybody that I'm sober, because I figured that everybody would find out that I had been in treatment. For some reason, I thought everybody would know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, but I told everybody I went to treatment, and then I don't know why I did, but
maybe as like insurance.
Well, later on, yes, that's true. But this time, I did it more out of like I'm good.
Yeah.
But two weeks later, I started drinking. My wife had left for a business or not business trip. She visited her sister, and I can't even tell you the alien feeling it was that I was possessed to go to the like a gas station and get like a beer, and it was just I felt controlled. But I was drinking like a tall boy of Miller Lite or something in a parking lot. And then after that, I told everybody that I was still sober. And then it was just, that was the most miserable thing. Because then I had people coming up to me saying, how do I get sober?
Right. How long you were doing that?
6 months.
That is so brutal. I hear about that as the most painful place to be. Were you going to meetings?
I went to a few. I went to enough to make it seem like I was, you know, sober. But that was a really dark, duplicitous feeling, too, because you're sitting there going, I'm lying to everybody. And that's one of my biggest fears, too, is being a fraud. You know, it's just because I'm like, am I just, you know, am I not really who I say I am? But yeah, I'm sitting in meetings and, you know, I would say I'm sober for, I lived for those month coins, even though I was still drinking. Wow. You know, it's just awful, you know, so.
And so, and then when did it really kick in?
So you mean there was a recovery? It was around the time when my wife found, you know, I was hiding bottles all around the house.
The washing machine?
Oh, I didn't do the washing machine because I knew she would use that, but I'd hide under the sink, in the grill cover. And I wasn't that artful of a hider. I just kept thinking I was. I would hide it in filing cabinets. We were finding bottles for months after I got sober.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
So she starts finding them.
She does. And then her mom came over to paint one day and she was painting the house and I was drunk. And I remember she just, she told me, very heartfelt. She just said, you sincerely have a problem and, you know, it's not okay. Cause no one up to that point had told me this is bad. My wife had been telling me, but I'm not going to listen.
So you mean your mother-in-law told you?
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, she told me in a very nice way, that you have a problem and you, are negatively affecting everybody in your life. So it was like a one woman intervention.
Right.
You know, it was just her and I. And I remember I'm still drunk. And she's not acknowledging that I'm drunk, but she's telling me all these things like, I think you need help. And I'm following her around the house as she's painting my house.
The intervention with the paintbrush. You might be the only person who's been intervened on while someone was painting.
Yeah, painting my house too, like manual labor. Too,
right, so. Right.
Yeah, but she told me. And then I was just like, you know, I'm going to try to, you know, go after this. So I got sober right after Christmas. And it was January 11th. And I remember, you know, Ohio winters are brutal. So remember, I just, that's how I felt. Was out, you know, just frozen. And I always say it's like, you know, these country roads, you know, like that. I just felt like these long country roads that I say are like scorched with salt, you know, just like that. That's how I felt. I didn't identify with anybody, but, you know, I didn't even want a sponsor. I didn't want to get help, but I just knew that I needed to not drink. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that was the trick was, you know, it's not about not drinking. It's about having a fulfilling life.
And so you were sort of, as they say, white knuckling it?
Yeah, definitely. And I remember telling my wife, I said, I was describing the people in the AA rooms, you know, she was like, what are they like? You know, like there's some sort of, you know, not cult, but just like, she wanted to know like what kind of people they are. And I said, and I remember her distinctly saying, is anybody like still married in those rooms? Because it was like, I said, there's a lot of divorcees and stuff.
Yeah.
But so I went to there I wouldn't have been sober or stayed sober if my sponsor, not my now sponsor, came up to me after a meeting and said, you really said something during the meeting that I hadn't thought of in a long time, which was, and he'd been sober at eight years at that point. And I'd said, I feel like my best friend died. You know, like everybody says, you know, so.
But he'd somehow never heard that.
I think he just forgot it, you know.
Because
I was in mourning, you know, so.
Yeah. I mean, and that is also the thing about meetings is that, you know, whatever, the built-in forgetter they talk about us having is you hear it and you're like, oh, I'm actually hearing that.
Right. So then after that, it was more or less just getting out of my own head and then really listening to people, which I'd never done, you know, really caring about people. And so I really started immersing myself in my own writing and, you know, like really writing about the experience I was going through.
So before you were publishing that writing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I would just journal. I would just like write. I wrote a book that wasn't even about sobriety. I just wrote a book. It just came out of me.
You're so insane.
I know.
You're
I just wrote a book.
More insane than I am. Okay.
Yeah. I wrote a whole book. It was like, 600 pages. I would never read it again, but
I won't read any of my books again, but
really
you no won't? God no.
Why?
Because because
you're so tired of
it? It's sort of painful. One time I went to speak at a college and I have to read to fall asleep.
Sure.
And I was selling copies of Party Girl.
Right.
So it was the only reading material in my room. And so I had to read it. And I was like, God, this is kind of good. I was surprised.
Were you surprised?
Yes.
You got it published. I mean,
I know. Well, my second
That's a good book.
My second book is terrible and I got that published.
It's not terrible.
You didn't read it. Did you?
I read all your books.
You did?
Yes.
That second one, man. But thank you. But honestly, I sometimes lose respect for people if I get an email and they're like, I really loved your book, Bob.
Oh, really?
I'm just like, what's wrong with you? But have you ever tried to get any of your books published?
No.
And why is that?
Because I'm so busy with other things. My whole life, you know, I've got a busy life right now. I just haven't.
Is this possibly a little bit of fear?
Oh, of course. I'm sure there's part of it. It probably goes back to that creative writing workshop where I don't want anybody saying anything about it.
But you're putting out hundreds of articles.
Yeah, that's what's giving me the encouragement really to start thinking about it, though. I mean, it's now it's more or less, all right, some part of this is good, you know, it took you to say that and other people all my life and say, you're a good writer, but I didn't believe it.
You know, right. I was the first person you believed.
I think so. I honestly think.
Truly?
I think so. Yeah.
But so, I mean, I will say this is a writing intervention.
Okay.
I will say that I find it bizarre, given the fact that you have written two books and that you write so much that you have never tried.
Yeah, I never have.
I mean, I really do find that interesting.
Yeah, there's a fear. I'm sure there's a fear factor to it. But
so this is my intervention where I say,
you have a paintbrush.
Well, and you know, I am a writing coach. So these are okay. So for forgetting the 600 page one for a second,
yeah,
right?
Which is not good.
And we're gonna hold up, and nobody can see it. The one that you handed me, which is also quite long, but the font is big.
Yeah, I just bound it for you. So
And it's a nonfiction book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drinking
memoir.
Drinking memoir. Now, why would you not write a proposal and send that out?
Because I don't know how that stuff works, really.
You know, I have a program that teaches that. And you know that I would give you access to it. Just give it to you.
I think I need to take advantage of that.
Yeah. And because
I'm trying to think of reasons not to, but I
mean, I'm sort of a little bit shocked you didn't sign up for it before.
I literally come to the precipice of this and I come up with a million excuses not to do things. I mean, it's as much as like, I could go to the gym right now, but I'm not going to.
Right.
It's just, right. I could keep doing it. But yeah, I.
We start again in October.
Yeah.
I might just require you to do it.
Okay.
Because, well, you know, and I encourage anybody out there, there are so many people in recovery that have these amazing stories.
I've never heard stories like the people in recovery rooms.
I know.
Some of the best articulate people I've ever heard are in the rooms.
And the recovery memoirs tend to do really well and they sell. So, yeah, I mean, you will be my model example.
Okay.
For all the people that are listening right now and want to write books. I'm telling you, you can do it. I had no idea. I just sat down one day and wrote one. I mean, not in a day.
I was going to say, I'm really impressed.
But, but here's the thing. I do know of people who write books in a weekend and it's crazy.
Was Party Girl your first book?
Yeah.
I mean, with the first actual book you wrote.
Yeah.
I mean, you just sat down, wow,
yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, the story about it is that my friend Melanie, she and I were talking and we said, I really want a book. I really want to write a book. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then she said, well, why don't we do this thing where have I told you this? We send each other 3 pages.
No.
We send each other 500 words every Sunday.
No.
Just to motivate each other. We don't read each other's material. We just send it to each other. And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I live in LA. So if something's not triple confirmed, I assume it's not happening. Like, it's just the land of flake. So the following Sunday, I get her 500 words. And I'm like,
oh no,
this girl was serious? So I write up the first 500 words of Party Girl. I just quickly wrote them, sent them to her.
Yeah.
Thought, well, at least we're done with this. Following Sunday, I get her next 500 words. And she really is serious. And then we did a month. And then I had 2,000 words. And she actually got a job and couldn't do it.
Right.
And I had 2,000 words and I kept going.
That's amazing. It's almost like sober time for me. It's like you start getting it under your belt. You're like, I got 1 month, 2 months, or it's the same with word count.
It is the same thing. And that's why, you know, I say everything I learned how to do, I learned in 12-step rooms because I learned how to do public speaking there.
Right.
Forget Toastmasters. Learn it, and I learned one day at a time. And I was like, no, I can't write a book, but I can write 3 pages a day.
Right. And you never read each other's work while you're sending
it?
No. She never told you this is really good?
No, she didn't read it. We didn't have time. I'm sure hers was amazing. I didn't read it either. That's why in my coaching program, I take an even number of students and I assign them each an accountability partner. And some of them are just really taking off, you know,
that's
because
amazing.
They're motivating each other.
That's a cool idea.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I do not think I would have any books if Melanie had not said that to me.
So do you think that you wrote Party Girl so, and it came out so quickly, the beginning of it, because you were so focused and hurried because you had to get 500 words out?
But I also think Party Girl was maybe the only really good idea I've ever had.
Okay.
Like, I don't, I knew the story, you know. I'm sorry, what we're talking way too much about. I'm interested. Writing, but like, you know, my story in real life was that I had, you know, was pretty much unemployable and this crazy party girl. And then I get this job at Premier Magazine writing a column called Party Girl.
Right.
And I'm suddenly sober and all I do is like play with my cats and go to coffee and smoke cigarettes. And so I was like, wait, that's a perfect story. Right. But if my column was about like interviewing celebrities, but what if it was a column about being a party girl and you really weren't one and you had to pretend to be one based on your past experience? And it was just like, oh, that's a good idea. So I just wrote it. Yeah. But anybody can do that.
Yeah. It's eminently readable too, I will say.
But thank you.
Yeah.
It starts off with a menage a trois, which is now embarrassing.
I wasn't going to acknowledge that part.
But thank you. Thank you. It's awkward, huh?
You brought it up.
And that's an interesting thing too. Do you have anything you've written that you sort of regret putting out there?
Oh my God. Yes. You know, some of the recovery articles that I've done for you,
right.
You know, I mean, I'll put that out there and all of a sudden it's like this immediate wince when I see it out there in the world,
right.
Or, you know, cause I would share not only just my articles, but a lot of the articles you guys would write for After Party and stuff. I would have, you know, share it out there and I'd see, you know, dozens of people commenting on these things. I'm like, they read that.
I know.
Because then you're just like, oh my God, they know these things about me. Yeah, of course I did.
Really?
Yeah, of course I regretted a lot of it. I mean, but I kept doing it.
I know. I have things early in my career that I do regret putting out there. Yeah, I was just so open. And I mean, I think some of the sex stuff, like I don't do that anymore. Like I really don't feel comfortable.
Right.
And you know, I believe everything happens the way it's meant to.
Sure.
So I was meant to do that.
Right.
But, you know, it's something that I also help people with is like, really, what are you comfortable putting out there? Because it's out there.
It's out there for good, too.
Yeah. So, okay. And so back to your recovery. So
sure.
Now you go to meetings.
And I tell everybody on the planet that I'm sober.
Yeah.
I told everybody.
Yeah.
And it accidentally came out at work.
Uh-huh.
Not that long ago, we had a big presentation in telepresence. And that's how the corporate world works anymore.
Yeah,
they don't fly anymore. They just have giant telepresence. And somebody said, you have to be able to describe something in 5 minutes. It could be anything. You pick a topic. And they had a room of, you know, we're all connected in these 12, 13 different sites. And they chose me. And I said, go ahead. You know, and I said, hi, I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, accidentally.
Yeah, in front of like hundreds of people. And I just kept going.
Right.
It was awful at first, but I'm, you know, so you talk about being regretful, but yeah.
Will you write that story for me at my new magazine?
Sure. That'll be the first one to do.
That's an amazing, crazy story because I've almost done it so many times.
It fell out and I've told that anecdote in an AA room and everyone's like, I thought that was going to happen to me and it never actually happened. I'm like, no, it really did happen in front of like hundreds of people. And then, you know, then you're sitting there kind of like, oh, I shouldn't have, my career over.
But maybe they thought you were kidding because...
Well, everybody laughed.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was just, and it's, we're a global company, so we're all over the place. So you have people in San Antonio, Manila, you know, it's all over the place. So people that you just laugh, but internally there's like this elevator plunge. And so I'm like, oh my God, why he's got to go for broke?
Right.
So I just kept telling a story.
Not a story about being sober.
No, I just said I'm a pie and pollen alcoholic and I described what it's like to be, I told my story.
Even though this was a work meeting?
It was, yeah.
How is that like even...
So I remember I have a letter from somebody who works in. That was the bravest thing I've ever seen anybody do.
Did people come to you afterwards and say, can you help me?
I had a couple, not as many as I thought, but I'm not an expert. I'm not a professional. I don't give a
who's device. An expert?
Yeah,
not
that's
me.
True. That's true.
And people, you know, come to me all the time.
I had a couple people saying that was super inappropriate, which is good. It's true.
But that's like at birthday parties. I don't know if you've ever, like, you sing happy birthday. Oh, do you guys not sing happy birthday in the meetings that you go to?
No, we don't actually.
Oh, it's like a California thing.
Is it?
You'll see. Oh, if we have any birthdays tomorrow, you'll see.
Cool. Yeah.
But you sing happy birthday and then you keep coming back.
Okay, well, thanks for the, I'm glad I know that.
So yeah. And so I've accidentally done that at like other.
Oh really?
Of course. Yeah. Well, so we have to work towards wrapping up. This
sure.
has been such a delight. So tell people where they can find you.
Sure. I actually started a web presence because you suggested it.
Mm-hmm.
You were starting your own, identifying your own brand. So you can find me at paulfuhr, FUHR.com.
Yep.
Or you can find my two podcasts, The Furious Podcast or DropTheNeedle.com or Drop the Needle on iTunes. So, but yeah, that's where you'll find
and
me.
And a whole slew of articles on After Party.
And I link straight to After Party.
Which you don't need to anymore because I'm not there anymore.
Well, After Party, all my articles, recovery articles. I've been published since... I've gotten, since I've had the articles published for After Party, I had a number of other articles published that were not even recovery related.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Literary Review picked me up. So
that sounds very literary. I don't know what that is.
It was, it's a journal that I would have never been published at, like when I was in grad school, but I was published just a couple of months ago.
Which and you're writing for the Fix.
Yes. So I have all of those on the site. So I'm. And I mean, that's all because of you, though, so I can't thank you enough.
Please keep talking about me.
Sincerely, this is the most surreal experience that I've had in a long time. I mean,
is it more surreal than reading your college papers?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, this has not been stressful for me, but I've been looking forward to it. But I'm also like, you know, for months, this has been a big deal for me to come out and do this, you know, with you.
And I'm so glad.
Well, you've changed my life in so many different ways. I mean, and just sobriety and with my writing. I mean, it's just it's just an honor. I mean, this is probably one of the highlights of my life. Not kidding.
Okay, now I'm getting embarrassed.
No, you shouldn't be. No, sincerely.
Oh, this is Paul. This has been so great. So you guys have been listening to Recover Girl / the Anna David Admiration Hour that I'll probably listen to this over and over. I mean, who knows? No, I don't. I don't even listen to these because it's too weird.
I can't hear myself talk.
You're not going to listen to this?
I'll listen to this one.
Okay. Because you have to because you're a subscriber.
Well, I'm going to worry that I'm going to listen to make sure first that I didn't say anything stupid. But
oh, God. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Everything you said was brilliant.
Except for the Dennis Quaid part.
That was my favorite part. Okay. So you've been listening to Recover Girl, podcast about addiction and recovery. It is released. Well, here's an exclusive. Been released every other week, and now I'm releasing them weekly.
Oh, wow.
Because I have a psychiatrist friend where we answer a question about addiction and recovery.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. The first one will come out. It doesn't make sense for the listener. It'll come out before. You'll have heard it already if you're a subscriber. But those are cool. And if you want to know more about this podcast, go to recovergirlpod.com. And Paul, thank you so, so, so much.
Oh, thank you. Are you kidding me?